Welcome to GoldSeek.com Radio for another Gold Nugget segment. Today's special guest, Peter Schiff from Euro-Pacific Capital. Well, Peter Schiff, President and Chief Global Strategist of Euro-Pacific Capital. Welcome, Peter Schiff.
Thanks for welcoming me back.
It's great to have you back. And I wanted to ask you a few questions here on some comments you've made regarding gold's rise this year. You say it's kind of thrown off Wall Street. The major bankers are somewhat perplexed. They've told their clients to sell. Even Goldman, which has, I think, one of the better track records, which may not be saying much, you know, not very sanguine on gold's prospects. Tell us more, please.
In fact, you know, I was in an interview on CNBC.com earlier today, and before I was on, former Congressman Ron Paul was on, and they asked him about gold, and they said, the announcer said, gold's had a very rough year so far in 2014. You know, you've been bullish on gold. What do you make of the market? Now, this is a CNBC anchor saying that gold has had a rough year so far in 2014. Gold is up about 8% on the year. It's up more than the stock market. So by what definition did gold have a tough year? Unless you're saying that, well, it wasn't up 20%, it was only up 8%. Maybe that's the definition of tough, but why don't they apply the same definition to the stock market? Because if the stock market's up 3 or 4% on the year, it's a great year. But gold's up 8% and it's having a tough year. So they don't really cover it fairly. Meanwhile, everybody was expecting the stock market to be up this year. In fact, it's up less than all the experts thought it would be, whereas those same experts expected gold to be way down on the year. Instead, it's doing better than the stock market. And they don't even acknowledge how wrong they were. They still pretend that they're right.
No, exactly. They report the news after the news. You know, the Dow has broken through the 17,000 mark, and I think this is what they're really focusing on, isn't it? They're looking at the new highs as gold as the bull market of the past, of 2011. What's going to take gold back to its former highs in the next couple of years?
Well, I think it's just going to be the continuation of the trend that's been in place really since 1999, 2000. It's been the Fed keeping rates too low, creating too much inflation, which has been driving the gold market. And it's not just our central bank. It's central banks in Europe. It's central banks in Asia. All over the world, there's all this money printing. They're not mining nearly as much gold as the money that's being printed. So the price of gold is going to continue to go up. Yeah, we've had one down year. I mean, since 2000, gold's had one down year. And to hear all the experts talk about gold, you'd think it was down every year but one. And, you know, they make fun of me. They say, well, Peter Schiff, you know, you're always saying gold's going to go up. I say, yeah, but, and it always has. I mean, ever since I've been talking about gold for the last 13, 14 years, I've been right every year except one. You know, and the reason I keep saying it's going to go up is because I know the likelihood is that it's going to go up in any given year. It doesn't mean it will go up every year. Maybe gold will go up, you know, over the next 14 years. Maybe it'll be have another down year, but maybe it'll have 12 up years. I don't know when the down year is going to happen, so I'm not going to bet on a down year in an uptrend, especially when I know it's got a long way to go. But, you know, the people that seem to catch a lot of, you know, they get a break are the people that are always negative on gold. Somehow they're the geniuses, the ones that have been saying every year, don't buy gold, it's going to go down. All of a sudden, they're stars because it went down in 2013. You know, they're wrong for a dozen years in a row. And then finally, oh, these guys know what they're talking about. They said gold was going to go down. Yeah, and they said it would be down in 2014. All the people that predicted gold would go down in 2013, they also predicted it would go down in 2014, and they've been wrong.
You know, another component, I think, to this story that people are missing, at least in the mainstream, is that we've seen money flowing from around the world, scared money, particularly from Eastern Europe, where there's a lot of trouble in the Middle East. There's very little safe havens other than the perceived U.S. stock market. They don't want to miss what they see as an opportunity. But, you know, that is oftentimes the sign of frothiness, that the trend could reverse course. That's going to make gold, precious metals, commodities, crude oil much more attractive. Tell us your thoughts.
Yeah, well, I think that commodity prices in general are going to outpace U.S. stock prices. But there are a lot of stock markets around the world. That's, you know, the stocks that we are investing in at Euro Pacific Capital, the ones we're buying for clients in our funds. That's where we find real value. You know, And I think the key is to try to avoid the enormous losses that are in the future, particularly for holders of paper money and these overvalued, overleveraged, hyped up stocks. I mean, not all stocks fit into that category, but there certainly are a lot of stocks that are trading at nosebleed valuations, similar to what we had in the dot-com bubble. But more importantly, that the overall bubble that underlies the U.S. economy is even bigger now than it was then. And I think it's interesting that you're having people debate whether or not the Fed potentially will keep interest rates too low too long and maybe inflate another bubble when that's already happened. You know, there was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend by the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas speculating that maybe if the Fed doesn't, you know, doesn't stop the stimulus, there's a danger of a problem developing. I mean, that article was at least 4 years too late. It already happened. You know, the Fed has already been too low for too long. The consequences are already going to be horrific when the Fed takes away the punch bowl, which is why they're not going to take it away. They're going to keep spiking it, and which means the ultimate consequence is going to be that much worse because of how much longer the punch bowl is going to be there.
No, exactly. And, we're starting to see some of the cracks, I think, develop here all throughout the system. The housing index is rolling over. It's done so for 4 or 5 weeks in a row consecutively. And this, I think, was a major component, an underpinning of the nascent recovery, this supposed economic recovery that we've had over the past few years.
Janet Yellen is basing her optimistic forecast on the U.S. economy in large part on the wealth effect associated with the rising real estate market. I mean, she's betting on the real estate recovery continuing as the source of the economic strength, when all the evidence already suggests that the rally is over and that it's rolling over and that now we're trending back down both in home prices and in real estate-related activity. Basically the rug is being pulled out from beneath the U.S. economy, just as the Fed is counting on that support growing, you know, because the Fed is saying, hey, we're going to stop the QE. We're going to stop buying mortgages. We're going to raise interest rates so mortgage rates go up. But if real estate is already falling now, if the market is already in decline with all the Fed's help, what's going to happen when the Fed goes from being a tailwind to a headwind?
I'd also like your comments on the new Fed chairman who has noted that we saw inflation, you know, surpass the Fed's 2% target, but they're just not worried, apparently, about this.
I'm sure they're worried privately, but, you know, what me worry, right? Because they have to pretend that inflation is not a problem, because otherwise they have to end QE and raise rates. So they have to continue to pretend that it's not a problem, but they also have to pretend that if it ever becomes a problem, they will act vigilantly to extinguish it, right? So they have to say, look, we don't see any inflation threat now, but trust us, if we ever do, we will quickly act, which is all the bluff, right? They can't do anything because to fight inflation, they would have to raise interest rates. They should already be doing that, but they can't do it because they would prick the bubbles in the stock market and the real estate market. We'd have a financial crisis worse than 2008. And so the Fed has to pretend that there's no inflation so that it doesn't have to do anything about it.
All right, let's talk about the mining shares. You've also noticed that there's some incredible opportunity opening up here. Even if gold and silver just perform well as they have, the technical situation and fundamentals are certainly looking much more positive for the precious metals mining stocks. We're even seeing divergence, a positive divergence, in the XAU, HUI, relative to their underlying metals.
Yeah, the stocks have certainly been leading the recovery in 2014, which is a good sign because they led the downturn in 2013 and even earlier than that. In fact, I think all the bad news is in the gold mining companies. It's hard to find a sector that was more universally despised at the end of 2013 than the gold stocks. So there are tremendous bargains. I think anybody who's going to sell has sold. Anybody who's going to short these stocks is already short. So all we really have is new buying to come into the market, short covering to come into the market. So I really think we're headed a lot higher in the gold stocks. That's why last year, in the second half of the year, I launched my first ever gold miner fund, the Euro Pacific a gold fund, EPGFX, I think is the symbol for my my gold fund. Yeah, that's it, EPGFX, managed by Adrian Day. And I think that, you know, people really want to, you know, swing for the fences. If you're looking for something that might go up 10 times or more, I think the mining sector is the place to look. I think that's where you get the biggest bang for your buck. And certainly if I'm right on the price of gold going way up, these stocks have a long way to go because they're already factoring in a much lower gold price. So if gold goes up instead of down, there's a lot of catching up that these stocks have to do. They're basically going to get re-rated, and all of a sudden everyone's going to have to look at them in a totally different light. And I think once people get their arms around the phoniness of this economy and the false nature of the recovery, when people realize that we're going back to recession, that the Fed is going to go back to the drawing board, you know, with more QE, that it's just going to be a perfect storm for gold. And I think the prices are just going to take off. And the key is to be invested in this sector, invested in these gold mining stocks before that happens. Because believe me, it's going to be very scary to try to chase this market once we see gold moving up in $50, $100 a day increments, and we start to see these gold stocks moving up 10, 20% a day. People might be nervous about buying. So it's better to buy now, you know, while it's quiet.
No, exactly. I mean, it does take some intestinal fortitude, but I think your thesis here is going to be proven correct. This is a momentum-driven market, and it's only going to be more so when the hedge funds and the deep pockets, you know, start to chase after the precious metals. Not only will you have the shorts running out of their positions, but then you'll also have some very hot money, pension fund money, $3 trillion worth of pension fund money.
Yeah, and you have to realize that these pension funds and these, you know, they have no exposure to gold mining stocks right now, zero. And so there's a lot of money out there that potentially could move into the sector. And, you know, it doesn't take significant allocations. If you get funds deciding that, hey, we need a 5% allocation to the gold sector, I mean, that is an enormous amount of money that would be flooding into a tiny sector. And, of course, as the market improves and the stocks start to go up, now you have the momentum players that are going to start – that are going to be attracted to the sector just based on the gains that they're missing out on by not being in. So it feeds on itself. And especially if we can start to see the gold stocks rising even as the general stock market is falling and people perceive now that, hey, I got to have these stocks as a hedge. Right? I got to have something that can go up when the rest of the market is going down. You know, there's so much pent-up demand that can be unleashed for this sector.
Another component here, I mean, we see the U.S. dollar struggling for years now, trying to find its footing. Every time it looks like it's going to enter a new uptrend, it just collapses right back down. Starting to look as though some of these more wild forecasts of impending U.S. dollar collapse could occur. Do you expect this to happen abruptly, or is it just going to be more of a gradual process like we saw from the year 2000?
Well, I guess it'll most likely be gradual until it becomes abrupt. So the answer is probably both. But, you know, it's interesting. The dollar index, which is around 81 right now, just north of 81, you know, all they talk about on the financial shows is the strength of the dollar and the dollar rally. And the dollar isn't really strong. I mean, it's not weak. In that it's not collapsing, but it's really not gaining much strength. And if you look at, you know, the dollar index in the year 2000 was at 120, so we're down about a third since then. It's hard to say that 81 on the dollar index represents a strong dollar, but what the strong dollar crowd should be more concerned with is why hasn't the dollar rallied more in the last year with all of the geopolitical tensions that would normally benefit the dollar, with all of the optimism about a U.S. recovery and the end of QE and the Fed raising interest rates, with all the pessimism on Europe and all the pessimism on Japan, why isn't the dollar index above 100? I mean, what, you know, and what that really shows me is that the fundamental weaknesses are just so dramatic that even when the dollar seems to have everything going for it, it still can't rally. And even more worrisome, if you're a dollar bull, look at what's happening with foreign central banks, particularly in the emerging markets. They have been stepping up their dollar buying to prevent the dollar from falling against their currency. So if you have an environment where you're claiming the dollar is strong, why do so many foreign central banks have to come to the dollar's rescue to artificially prop it up to prevent it from falling in an environment where it should be rising? So I think that really shows the inherent weakness in the dollar. And I think when the preponderance of the economic evidence proves my thesis correct, that we're not recovering, that in fact we're relapsing back into recession, and when the Fed is forced to come back to the economies and the markets' aid with even greater quantities of QE, I think that is going to, you know, knock this support out from beneath the dollar, and it's going to be lookout below.
All right, let's talk about some of the geopolitical risks. I personally feel that the mainline media is discounting some of the possible ramifications of the Middle East, particularly there in Iraq, as well as trouble between Israel and other nations. And then, of course, we have the Ukraine-Russia drama. I'd like to see how this factors into your analysis.
You know, I mean, it really doesn't, because I don't really understand how these geopolitical events are going to unfold. You know, obviously, there is potential there for serious problems that could be very disruptive to the global economy, that could, you know, be disruptive certainly to the U.S. and our ability to borrow and spend money. But I really don't know, you know, how it's going to end. You don't really know what events are going to happen. I think that the greatest threats to the U.S. economy are not external, they're domestic. Although anything that would cause the world to lose confidence in the dollar and stop supporting the dollar is something that is of great concern. So if some of these conflicts hasten the dollar's demise as the world reserve currency, and certainly to the extent that, you know, we get involved in areas like the Ukraine and start pissing off Putin or other people, we start throwing weight around that we really don't have anymore. And also, you know, we've been on a rampage of fining foreign central bank and foreign banks, whether it's France or Switzerland, and you know, now with Germany, you know, we don't give them their gold back, and we spy on Angela Merkel. I mean, we're creating a lot of problems, and I think our image and our reputation is suffering. And to the extent that these geopolitical events, continue that, America could end up losing the support that it should have already lost from foreign governments. And that's what we count on. I mean, that's what keeps our dysfunctional bubble economy going, is the fact that we fooled the whole world into supporting it for us. And they, you know, they lend us the money we need to buy things, and then they ship us the stuff that we buy on credit. So they provide us with the goods we consume, and they lend us the money to pay for it. And, you know, that's the secret to our success, is, you know, the world's foolishness in propping us up. So some of these events that we're seeing may hasten the world waking up and coming to the conclusion that continuing this scheme is not in their best interest. I mean, it's never been in their best interest, but they just have to come to terms with that.
Give people an idea on what you see with regard to this amazing equities rally we've seen. You know, the Dow Jones at its, 118-year all-time record high, almost weekly now, we're having record closes.
If you price the Dow in gold, it's nowhere near its record high. So, you know, you're pricing it in terms of U.S. dollars, which themselves are losing a lot of value. So it's not, a really significant rally. But what's fueling it is the Fed. I mean, the fact that the market is going up, despite the fact that the economic fundamentals are deteriorating, that makes, it makes the bubble bigger, because stocks should be going down. Instead, they're going up. And so, you know, the price of stocks versus the value, that gap keeps getting wider and wider. And what's supporting it is share buybacks that are being made possible by low interest rates. It's the fact that corporations can have such low payments on their debt. They can buy back shares and reduce the number of shares outstanding. And their customers can rely on cheap credit to buy their products. So that also drives their top line. So I think the entire stock market is built on the foundation of cheap money. And if that foundation is removed, the market's going to come crashing down in a very spectacular way. But it, you know, if that foundation is not removed because the Fed doesn't want to have that happen, then it's the dollar that's going to come crashing down in a spectacular way. And, you know, even if the stock market goes up, the question is, will it go up enough to compensate for the loss of value of the dollar? And for most people, I think the answer is no.
No, exactly. And, you know, we're still seeing the erosion of purchasing power, which, of course, is an indirect effect from the scenario you've laid out here. Just when will the masses of people, when will the hoi polloi wake up to what's going on? They obviously see their paychecks and purchasing power declining. They're seeing cost of goods and services, groceries and whatnot, moving up steadily year after year.
The masses are not in the stock market right now. I mean, they're too broke to buy stocks. And they already are appreciating the fact that their lives are getting worse, that the American dream is becoming more and more elusive for them, that their circumstances, their personal circumstances are deteriorating. You know, their job doesn't pay as much as it used to. Their bills are mounting. Things cost more. Their electric bills are higher. Their food bills are higher. Their medical costs are higher. So the mass has already experienced this. The question is, you know, when are the investors, when are the top 1% or 5%, whoever's still, you know, prospering in this bubble economy, when are they going to come to their senses? When are they going to figure out that this whole thing is a charade? Because I think a lot of people in the middle class, they are, you know, they don't buy all this nonsense about a recovery. I mean, you look at the polls, and a lot of people still think it's a recession. And they're the ones that are right. It's the so-called experts that still don't understand. They're the ones that have been taken in by the con of this, you know, mirage of a recovery. So, you know, when are they going to figure it out? And for the majority, it's going to be too late. I mean, it's going to have to be collapsed. But when did people figure out there was a housing bubble? Most investors figured out there's a housing bubble after it burst. I mean, way after it burst. I mean, the whole thing had imploded. You know, Fannie Mae was broke by the time the masses acknowledged, yeah, I guess we had a housing bubble. You know, so the same thing is going to happen this time around. The vast majority of investors are going to remain clueless until they've lost most of their money. Then they'll figure it out.
Well, not to mention we have the foxes guarding the hen house. I mean, we had Henry Paulson, who was one of the architects of the housing boom vis-a-vis the derivatives there, the mortgage-backed securities, CDOs, swaps, and whatnot. So, I mean, when you have this interconnection between Wall Street and Capitol Hill.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's even worse when it comes to the Federal Reserve because, you know, the Federal Reserve was the primary architect of the housing bubble. It was their cheap money that inflated it. Yeah, the government played a part by guaranteeing mortgages and the tax code and all that, but the principal architect was the Fed. And then as a result of the financial crisis, right, that was a consequence of the Fed's mistakes, the Federal Reserve was given even more power to protect us from the next crisis, even though we need protection from the Fed. And by giving the Fed more power, they didn't work to make sure that we didn't have another crisis. They guaranteed that the next crisis would be that much worse.
Exactly. $700 billion or else. The irony there is that nothing has changed. It's actually gotten worse. We didn't go back to the Stiegel Act. Now we have Dodd-Frank.
No, nothing has gotten better. The only thing we've managed to do is partially reflate the bubbles, and everybody looks at that as a sign of success. I mean, that's how ridiculous it is. They say, oh, we got the stock market back up, we got the bond market and the housing market back up, so everything has worked. No, it hasn't worked. Propping up home prices is not part of the solution. Propping up home prices was part of the problem. We need to let home prices fall to the point where they're affordable by regular Americans who can use their savings for a down payment. The only people that can buy houses right now are highly leveraged hedge funds. The home ownership is at a 20-year low among, you know, actual families. I mean, first-time home buyers, too. It's all-time record lows. So we need lower home prices. The reason that people can't afford to buy their first home is because the prices are too high. The market would want to correct the problem by bringing prices down. But the government distorts the economy and worsens the problem by artificially propping them up. And by doing it, it's diverting resources away from where they need to be and putting them where they shouldn't be. And all of this has undermined the economy. It's why we're not creating real jobs. It's why we don't have any legitimate economic growth. It's why we have this increasing divide between the very rich and the very poor. It's Fed policy that is responsible, that is driving all these trends, and it needs to be reversed.
But I'd still point to fiscal irresponsibility because, look, we have shifted virtually 90% of the residential home mortgage market into these government-sponsored enterprises.
Remember, the fiscal irresponsibility is a function of the Fed. If the Fed was not buying up all the government debt, if the Fed wasn't buying up all these mortgages, we couldn't afford to be fiscally irresponsible because nobody would lend us the money. So the only thing that is driving the big deficit spending is the Fed. If the Fed acted independently and did its job and refused to participate in this, refused to monetize government debt, right? If they really acted like an independent central bank, then we would have a much smaller federal government today. But because the Federal Reserve is cooperating with the government and it's enabling the deficits and enabling this enormous growth of government, that is the problem. And as long as the Fed has got interest rates at zero, as long as they're willing to print money and buy government bonds, then there's no reason for the government to stop borrowing. They're not going to stop borrowing until they run into some negative consequences as a result of the borrowing. But if the Fed is postponing all the negative consequences, why on earth would any politician risk not getting reelected by cutting spending when they can spend whatever they want without any negative consequences because the Fed is there protecting them?
This trouble you speak of, I mean, it really harkens back to the fractional reserve banking system, which is founded falsely on this idea of, you know, creating money out of thin air.
I have no problem with fractional reserve banking without government interference. I mean, we were on a fractional reserve system before the Federal Reserve. I mean, when people took their gold to a bank and deposited, banks didn't keep 100% gold reserves behind the notes that they issued. So there was always a balance. I mean, private bankers need to have a reserve ratio that works. I mean, they have to instill confidence in their depositors that they have enough gold on hand to meet any demands, but they still want to maximize profits and, you know, so that they can pay higher interest rates to their depositors on the gold that they're storing. So there's always going to be some kind of fractional reserve banking in a free market. But I think the free market will find a stable ratio that works. But what happens is the government comes in and insures all the deposits and says no matter how highly leveraged your bank is, no matter how little reserves they have behind the deposits, we're going to protect those deposits in case there's a run. That's the problem. It's the government-guaranteed bank accounts that is the reason that we have this, you know, the fraction that we hold as a reserve is so tiny. You know, in a free market, we would have fractional reserve banking, but the fraction of that was held on reserve would be much, much higher than what exists under the government system. And I don't necessarily think that that is an unhealthy free market development. And especially when you have the banks differentiate between demand deposits, right, which they don't loan out because they're available on demand, and a time deposit where you buy a CD, that doesn't mature for 5 years, why should the bank sit on that money for 5 years? Why can't it lend it out, right? Especially when you've told the bank, I don't want my money for 5 years. So that, you know, you have to have a differentiation, and we used to. But today, the banks treat all deposits as if they're the same. They don't care if it's a time deposit or a demand deposit. They lend it right out.
Yeah, but that's really a function of the fact that there's just nothing underlying money in general. I mean, I agree with you. If we go back to the days of the goldsmith, sure, you had at least some substance underlying your currency, but in 1971, we eliminated that altogether, the vestiges. So, I mean, that really puts us in a position where the house of cards just continues to build and build and build, but inevitably, it's going to have to implode. And, you know, as we wrap up here, Peter Schiff, I wonder if you could give people an idea of how much they need to be invested. What would the typical investor who's had some nice gains in bonds and stocks over the past decade or so, what fraction of their portfolio should they invest in the miners and in underlying precious metals, please?
At least 10%, if not 20 to 25%, I think should be in physical gold and in the mining sector, especially given how cheap the sector is right now. Once we get a significant rally, you might, you know, pair off your position a little bit. But given the incredibly low valuations right now, you really need to have, I believe, you know, an overweight position in that sector. I think it's one of the only sectors that I think can deliver those type of, you know, extraordinary gains going from where we are right now. But I also think that investors should really be divesting themselves of U.S. dollar-denominated investments. I mean, they really shouldn't be in the bond market. They shouldn't be, whether it's corporate, treasuries, muni market. They shouldn't even be in the U.S. stock market in general. They should be looking abroad. They should be looking at the developing markets, the markets where there's a lot of good valuations. And you have to realize that if, you know, I'm right on the dollar collapsing relative to other currencies, not just losing value in terms of purchasing power, but losing value in an exchange rate, I mean, losing value, you know, to other currencies, then what's going to happen in the world is a realignment of relative wealth and global purchasing power, where Americans are going to get a lot poorer and people in certain countries are going to get a lot richer, because the production, the factories that are exist in the world, they're not going anywhere. I mean, they're still here. They're still going to produce. The difference is who is going to be able to afford to buy the output from those factories. And I think in the future, Americans are not going to afford much of it because they're going to be outbid by the foreigners. I mean, right now we're outbidding a lot of people in emerging markets because of the relative value of our currency versus theirs. But if the dollar plunges against these other currencies, then the tables are turned. Now foreigners outbid Americans, and so now Americans have to go without stuff, and now foreigners get to take their turn at consuming. And especially since it's their factories that are doing the producing, you would figure that it's only natural that they should get to consume what they produce, and we, you know, Americans will be left with nothing. And so, but the way to position yourself for this transition is to invest in those countries, own the currencies that are going to go up as the dollar goes down, be invested in companies that are going to be catering to consumers, customers, who are going to be much wealthier in the future than they are right now. I think there's a tremendous amount of money to be made by people who can act in advance of this dynamic shift that we're about to experience in the world. I mean, it's a big change in the global pecking order. America was on top. I don't know if we're going to go all the way to the bottom, but we're going to sink a lot lower than we are now, and people have to understand that, and they have to be positioned for that. You know, there was a lot of money made betting on America in the 19th century when we were a rising power. Well, now there's going to be a lot of money made betting against it. Unfortunately, that's the bet you have to make. The people who are still betting on America don't understand how dramatically America has changed. Right? We're not the country we used to be. We're not this bastion of free market capitalism. We don't have sound money and limited government. We're a socialist state. We're a bankrupt state. We have enormous debts. And people have to understand that really the only thing that's been standing between us and complete collapse is the ignorance of the rest of the world, who still loans us money as if nothing has changed, as if we were still the wealthy Bretton Woods economy that, you know, that existed at the end of the Second World War.
I know it's not going to be a popular comment, but I mean, I listened to one pundit point out over the weekend that we could very well be one of the, if not the most socialist countries in the world now. You know, the irony I see there is that China, which was, you know, the quintessential communist country,
it's capitalism, it's economic freedom. And in many respects, the Chinese enjoy greater economic freedom than do Americans. And, of course, there's lots of other countries. I mean, you know, you could argue right now that, you know, we're the least free country, certainly in North America. I think there's more freedom in Canada and Mexico, actually, than the United States. There's plenty of countries in South America, Chile, Peru, you know, where the level of economic freedom is significantly greater than it is in the United States. But also, if you look at the direction that we're going, and we're going, unfortunately, very rapidly in the wrong direction, but the pendulum is swinging away from freedom to statism, to, you know, socialism. Other countries, the pendulum is swinging in the other direction because they started off with lots of socialism and now they're moving away from it because it's so bad, because they, you know, they realize from experience how bad it is, and so they're trying to move in the opposite direction. And so, yeah, it's a very, very scary time to be in the U.S. It's dangerous to be investing here, but I'm hopeful that after we have this complete economic implosion that's coming, that maybe we'll learn our lesson. Maybe it can be the catalyst to get that pendulum going back in the other direction. I'm certainly going to do everything I can to push it in the other direction. And I'm trying to help as many Americans as I can now protect their wealth. I think that's the key, that, you know, we have to have Americans who don't go down with this ship, who, you know, who get their money invested abroad, who buy these foreign stocks that I think are going to do so well, that invest in precious metals and mining stocks. That's what I'm trying to help people do at Euro Pacific Capital, at Euro Pacific Precious Metals, is getting people out of dollars and into the right assets so that they don't go broke. And I think that if you preserve or enhance your wealth, you're going to be in a much better position to be a positive force in trying to change the course of this country and get it moving back into the right direction, and also providing the capital. Because if we're going to regrow this economy, we need capital. We need savings. We need to be able to repatriate our money and bring it back from abroad, use some of our gold to put it back into productive investments here in the United States.
Well, you have to stop frightening capital. You know, there was an interesting study done, studied all the empires beginning way before the Roman Empire up into the United States. And he noted several commonalities, about seven. One of them in particular, they last about 250 years. Here we are at about 240 years into our empire. And they always begin with pioneers, as we saw our pioneers heading, go west, young man. You'll remember that cliche. Eventually, it ends up, and this is fascinating, decadence, debased currency, political elite at the top trying to do everything they can to skim what they can get to line their own pockets. And keep in mind, this is every single empire.
Yeah, you know, and apart from the decadence, I guess, you know, that's okay. Yeah, the rest of it is all bad stuff. The decadence is the fun part.
There you go. All right. Well, I'm not going to argue with you there on that bit of levity. Let's wrap up the show here. Peter Schiff, please tell folks more about the services you provide.
Yeah, well, we provide a full array of financial services, brokerage and managed accounts through my U.S. broker-dealer, Euro Pacific Capital, Euro Pacific Asset Management. People can go to europac.net, europac.net. If you want to buy physical precious metals and you don't want to get ripped off, you know, when you do, you don't want to pay a big markup. My gold company is shiffgold.com is the URL. Easy to remember, just my last name, S-C-H-I-F-F-gold.com. For anybody listening who's not an American, if you're lucky enough to live in another country, you can work with me through my bank at Europac Bank, E-U-R-O-P-A-C Bank, B-A-N-K.com. We provide all these services that we do in America through the bank, including the gold and silver backed debit cards, which I wish we can offer those in the States. We can't, but we do offer them offshore for people who want to have, you know, immediate access to their gold and silver via, you know, the debit, a Master or Visa card system. So it really makes it easy for you to put yourself on a gold or silver standard, whichever you want. And remember, my bank is 100% reserve bank. So we talk about fractional reserve banking. We have 100% reserves at my bank. So nothing is loaned out. All the income that we generate at the bank is fee-based. So it's not, you know, we're not making any loans. We're not doing anything with your deposits. So that's Europac Bank. And again, you know, people want to follow me, go to my YouTube channel at Schiff Report, listen to me on the radio at the website for my radio show. What I do every day is Schiff Radio, schiffradio.com. So check it out. I mean, I'm doing, you know, doing a show Monday through Friday, 2 hours a day. If you can't listen live, you know, just you can listen whenever. We keep replaying the show until the next show comes on.
Excellent. Keep up the great work.
I appreciate the opportunity.